Donald on a Kitchen talks about food. Donald on a Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on a Kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Donald on a Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. We talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. Also, I want to tell you a little bit about this radio station. This radio station is good for a lot of what we do around here, and we're kind of sliding into 10 years of serving the community. So happy birthday, KHOI. A few news items before we start. The Iowa State Fair has come and gone, and, you never guess what's the most favorite food at the Iowa State Fair. They have a contest, and all the vendors make these food things. And for Iowa people at the Iowa State Fair, evidently excess won out this year. The winner is the finisher from the Rib Shack. It beat out 52 other food fairs and food fair contestants, and it has everything. It has it starts with the baked potato on the bottom, but it is topped with chopped brisket, pulled pork, and garlic and sour cream and garlic rub butter and cheese and this had everything. So of course that was the favorite food this year at the Iowa State Fair. Yes, we survived. We did. And also, it must be summer because the downtown Ames Farmers Market had their annual salsa contest, and people were dipping and tasting all on Saturday morning. So the tomatoes are coming in. The tomatoes are coming in. Community-supported agriculture. Huh? It's a good idea that has more of us connecting with local farmers and local food. CSAs have been around since, end of the last century, the 1990s in Iowa, more or less. So community-supported agriculture is people directly supporting a farmer to grow their food. They pay money up front and get food all during the growing season, and it has grown, and people, we salute the people that started this experiment a couple decades ago. Our guest today has a good perspective on this issue. Angela Tedesco has written a book about her farming experience. It is called Finding Turtle Farm, My 20-Acre Adventure in Community-Supported Agriculture. Welcome, Angela Tedesco.
Thank you for inviting me.
Good. I am glad you could be with us today. So, tell us about Turtle Farm and how you got into this thing.
I had a moment of insanity, apparently. Many years of insanity.
That too.
Well, I was doing other things. I had an undergraduate degree in chemistry, so I pushed test tubes for a while in research labs, and you know, that was just a job. And then I stayed home and got to raise our daughters, and that was a wonderful job. And then I was a religious educator at our church, so I feel like I took a full swing from science to religion, and the combination of the two was this desire to do something with plants. And so I went back to school at Iowa State to get my master's in horticulture with the thought of having an organic fruit farm. And while I was going to school those years, I learned about community-supported agriculture because I was interested in organic agriculture because as a chemist, I was concerned about the chemicals that were being put on food and what, you know, I didn't want to feed my children. So I was an early advocate of organic food growing in my backyard after getting my degree then, and learning about community-supported agriculture. It fit my value system because it is a cooperative venture. As you mentioned, you know, the consumers are supporting the farmer. I didn't want to have to go to a farmer's market and hope that I sold everything. When I have a CSA, I know everything is pre-sold and all I have to do is fulfill that commitment, which can be stressful at times when you have drought or flood or so forth. But I went into this thinking, oh, I've tried to do this for about 10 years, and 17 years later, I was still doing it and found it very enjoyable. I enjoyed the connection to the land, which I already had it or could have in my backyard, and I grew up on a small farm. But I also enjoyed more than I thought the connection with the consumers who supported me through that. And I came to enjoy educating them about subjects that came up on the farm, everything from that's a kohlrabi, you didn't know that, or somebody wanted to know what a Brussels sprout was. How do you describe a Brussels sprout? Little cabbages on a stem. Things like that, or they'd call them and say, what's this yellow spiny thing in my box? Because they would get a box of vegetables every week for about 20 weeks, and I would give them this newsletter that helped educate them about the farm, what was going on. I'd tell them what was in their box, and then I would give them recipes. So after doing that for 17 years, I did retire, and as I was putting away these files of all my newsletters, I was rereading some of my columns I'd written about the farm, and that was like the adventures, where the adventures in the CSA comes from in my book. So I don't know if you want me to keep talking or if you'd like to answer.
Well, I want to explain one thing from the eater's side of the CSA is what you end up with is a box that you do not choose. You have to get what the farmer has grown, and of course that changes over the season. And I imagine that probably the biggest learning curve between the farmer and the consumer is, what is this vegetable? And you must have ended up teaching people basically how to cook.
Well, I think I did for some of them. I did have some gourmet cooks who were signed up, so that wasn't a problem for them. But I think there's a whole generation of young people that did never learn how to cook.
Yep.
It wasn't something, you know, there's too many other adventures going on. They're out doing sports or whatever. And I probably didn't even do a good enough job with my own children, although they are wonderful cooks right now in their own right. So, yeah, it was an education process for sure.
So your book has a lot of recipes in it.
It does. By the way, I thought, well, you know, people will want to read a book and then they might pass it on and give it to somebody. But if they had recipes, they'd want to keep it and have to buy their friend's book.
Good marketing thinking, point. Angela. Good thinking. That's lovely. Are these recipes that came from your, you've had them a long time, or were they sort of come up just to meet the needs of your CSA boxes?
A little of both. I certainly have some family recipes there that came from my husband's mother and from my mother. There's also ones that my customers would submit, and I'd ask them, you know, submit a recipe that you like, you know, because if you like it, somebody else probably will too. And there are some that I created along the way. I've never been great at creating my own recipes, but somehow over those 17 years, I got better at it. And sometimes when I would be inspired by a dish, like we're very lucky in that we got to go to France a couple of years, and I went to a restaurant there with this wonderful ercovert salad, which means green bean salad, with the skinny green beans, French green beans. And it was so delicious. When we went back to the same restaurant the next night, I ordered again, but it was not the same dish because it was missing a few key ingredients. It was missing pine nuts and Parmesan over the top of this. And it's basically a salad with a vinaigrette dressing on it. So I came home and created that on my own and put it, you know, out to my customers.
Great. Yes, this has been a good year for green beans. It's nice to know. Now, can you back up and explain exactly? This was a cold green bean salad.
Yes.
Oh, sounds lovely. With a vinaigrette dressing on. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you touch it off with some toasted pine nuts, or if you don't like pine nuts, you could do walnuts. And then over the top, you grate some Parmesan cheese. And, of course, there's salt and pepper in there to your liking, but yes.
I would say that pine nuts and Parmesan will fix a lot of vegetables. Sounds good to me.
Good.
We'll try it on kohlrabi.
Oh, very good. Very good.
That's true. You could shave some kohlrabi, toss it in a vinaigrette, and put the Parmesan and pine nuts on it. It would work, Angela.
It would work. It would work.
I don't know.
In the introduction to your book, you mentioned you grew up in Oklahoma. So what are some recipes that you brought from your past in Oklahoma?
Well, probably there are a couple. One of them is a little extreme, and I mentioned poke greens, which we would harvest off the side of a road and cook up. But that's, you know, that's eating weeds, and it takes special skills to do that. The poke greens can be toxic, so you have to cook them twice in water, pour the water off before you eat them. So not many people are going to have the opportunity to do that. But another very southern dish that I wasn't even sure I could grow in Iowa was okra. And it grows quite well in Oklahoma. And it actually grows well in Iowa. There have not been many summers where I had an okra failure.
It is a foreign vegetable to many Iowans, but I happen to love it. And I noticed your book has got some okra recipes in, and thank you for that, because that is a okra really doesn't look like much of any other kind of vegetable.
FYI, Lana grows a lot of okra herself.
I got kind of caught by the okra bug too. I don't know why I just started it, although I ran across a book a couple years ago called The Whole Okra by Chris Smith, and it's a funny book, but he's a okra fanatic, and he writes everything about the science and the use and the how to cook, and I learned a lot, and I realized that the reason okra doesn't look like, well, like other vegetables that you would tend to find here is because it is related to cotton, believe it or not, cotton and hibiscus. So think of hibiscus flowers and, and some other sort of fiber sort of things. And anyway, I really like it. Oh, and it's also related to mallow, as in marshmallow.
Oh, yeah, they all have those big flowers.
Yeah. Great. So share with us, Angela, your okra. How do you like okra? How do you like to cook it?
I like it, first of all, every year when it comes through, my first way to fix it is the way my mother fixed it, which is, you know, slice to break an egg over it and dump in a little cornmeal and flour in equal amounts to soak up the egg. And then I pan fry it in just a small amount of oil as I can get by with, but enough in the oil of your choice. And brown it, and that's it. That's my first choice, because I grew up with that.
I have a question about that recipe. So does that make like a pancakey thing, or is it just like more like a breaded discrete pieces of okra?
It's more like a light breading. I don't try to make it to I don't try and make them stick together.
Very good.
That might take two eggs.
We could do that. Well, in this book about okra, I found that, of all things, Oklahoma has a official state meal, and no other state really has an official state meal. In 1988, they voted on it, and it comprises of fried okra, cornbread, barbecue, pork, squash, biscuits, sausage and gravy, grits, corn, strawberries, which is the Oklahoma state fruit, chicken fried steak, and black-eyed peas. So,
goodness, that's a large meal.
Oklahoma would start out with okra. It's the first on the list. And no other state has a state meal. I mean, you have the state rock. You have the state flower. Oklahoma evidently has a state meal. Louisiana has a state cuisine. All it says is gumbo, but it is not a whole meal. So that's good. And I'm glad to see that okra is on that. It's a good thing. It's a good thing.
All right. Well, the usual thing that comes up with okra when anybody mentions it and they go, oh, it's the ick factor, is that it's slimy. Now, I don't mind that. I like it. I think it has its own distinct flavor. It certainly has its own distinct texture. But there are ways, besides the fried way that Angela just mentioned, to cook okra without it being slimy. And Lana's husband was telling me a new technique the other day. Can you tell us what that was, Lana?
Oh,
where he swears it's not slimy.
See, you can't keep up with Joe in the kitchen, but he tried this. Found it online. Where'd you find anything?
Non-slimy okra, right? That was the name of the recipe.
Right.
Okay.
You slice okra the long ways, just toss it lightly in olive oil and fry it in, put it in a pan and fry it in the oven, bake it in the oven.
Oh, so you're baking it.
Baking it in the oven, and you end up with kind of like French fries, like okra fries.
You bake it long enough that it actually kind of dries out and gets crispy?
Yeah, you want crispy, which is how I like it, crispy, crispy.
Wow.
And, Angel, you've got something in your book called Roasted Okra with Sherry Mayonnaise. Now, that sounds like a good thing to
add. Do tell that recipe.
Well, that was submitted by a customer, so, but I do like Joe, I do like to roast okra as another alternative. Only I've never cut mine in half, so I will have to try that. That probably will allow it to crisp up more because when you just roast the whole pot, it seems to kind of steam on the inside. Mm-hmm. It's probably harder to get it crispy, so I'll have to try that. But yes, that was submitted, and this was from a customer who's a gourmet cook, and she held a cooking class, which I lobbied for her to do for my customers. And this was one of the dishes, and she had this wonderful dip that you dip them in after, you know, you've roasted the okra. So I don't have that memorized. So,
Lana's got it.
We've got it here. It's called Sherry Mayonnaise. Mayonnaise, sherry vinegar, parsley, garlic, lemon juice, salt and pepper to taste, and people are just going to have to look up your book to find that recipe.
So it's kind of like an aioli with sherry vinegar in it. Sounds good.
Right.
That's great.
Right.
Well, actually, in your book, one of your chapters refers to a delicious revolution. And it's nice, you know, we think that, saving the planet with organic agriculture is just, we just have to do that, but it is a joy. It is a wonderful thing. It's wonderful to have such a fun thing to share and bring families to the table again. Yes. Can you talk about your academic background? You mentioned coming through the sciences and wanting to connect up with people more. And in academia, you talk about that in a chapter called The O Word. Can you talk about what the O word means?
It's funny you should ask because somebody just told me that should be okra.
No, not different one. This O word.
But no, when I wrote the chapter, I was only thinking of organic agriculture, which for some people, I guess, is a dirty word, but I think it's great. So I talked about my...
I think of it as a clean word.
It's a clean word.
Yeah.
Or a fuzzy, prickly word. That's okra. Where was I? Oh, I told about this professor after I defended my thesis for my master's, who saw me afterwards, and I thought he was going to give me a compliment, and he said, I wouldn't do this organic thing if I were you, Angela, because I was looking at organic production systems for strawberries in my research. And it was like, you know, this organic stuff is not just based on economics. It's a part of me. It's part of how I want to grow my food and how other people want their food to be grown. And so it was worth it to me to go through the process of getting certified so people can find me in organic directories. And it was certainly a process. It wasn't always easy. In the winter, you spend at least a week getting the paperwork together to do this and then to get certified. When I bought the farm that we had, my husband and I bought the farm that we wound up with for the last 14 years, it had been farmed conventionally. So we had to wait the full 3 years to get it certified organic, although I was using organic practices for those 3 years. And, you know, you might lose some customers because of that, but because I had the CSA, I explained to them, you know, okay, we're not going to be called organic for the next 3 years, but here's what I'm doing and why. And I think I only lost one customer in that transition.
I want to note here that any farm or grower who has gone through organic certification must have 3 years on the land with no chemical use using organic methodologies before they even get certified. And this is called the transition period. That's what Angela's talking about. And it's necessary to try to mitigate the things, the chemicals, the fertilizers, the pesticides that have been, that are still lingering in the soil from the conventional agriculture. So that's why I call organic the clean agriculture, right?
It is.
So you got through your 3 years.
Yes, I got through the 3 years and got certified organic so I could get listed. Some people would find me that way. Most of my people, I think, found me by word of mouth.
Yeah.
At least initially.
Yeah. Well, the word of mouth, if I remember correctly, when Angela was farming, was that your strawberries were the best. She was known for her strawberries.
Yes.
Yes, it was a favorite crop. I think asparagus, strawberries, raspberries, and tomatoes were the favorite crops overall. The fruits certainly were an attraction for people.
Yeah, it's wonderful how, well, I do that too when I go out to the garden. There are certain things I really like, and somehow if you like a certain vegetable or some certain vegetables, somehow you give them a little bit more love out there, and it shows. So,
well, but that still doesn't make okra the favorite, I'll bet you.
Well, I like okra. And I want to say another good thing about okra. Okra is one plant that grows up to meet you. I don't have to bend over and pick them. I can kind of just stand there, and I appreciate that from okra. Well, actually, raspberries do that too, but see, strawberries, I don't think they don't grow waist high, although maybe you're working on that, Angela. I'm not. I like a plant that comes up to meet me.
I think my customer's first experience with okra is if they would see it, they would say, oh, what's that beautiful flower? Because it looks like a yellow hibiscus flower. And then I told them it was okra, and the conversation might end then. But okra was one crop that, in my CSA, people had to request because I was not going to waste it on anyone who wasn't going to want it or use it.
Good idea.
Well put.
People who wanted okra would, I had a whole list, and we'd go down that list and throw it in their box. So.
Very good.
Appreciate.
Yeah, the people that are in the know, you kind of appreciate people that appreciate okra. That's good. Well, I'm going to take a little break here and tell everybody this is KHOI. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about food from Turtle Farm with Angela Tedesco today. And I want to say a little bit about that music we just heard. That is called the Gaspé Reel. And I don't know if anyone else remembers, but way, way back on public television in the 1970s, there was a amazing new, radical new program called The Victory Garden, and that was the theme song for it. I just happened to know that was the Gaspé Reel. I know that, but that was kind of the first time that I sat down and watched a guy growing things intentionally, lots of good vegetables, lots of good organic methods. Well, now, he didn't always use organic methods, but he kind of inspired me. I think his name was James Crockett. So I don't know how many other folks remember the Victory Garden from way back in the middle of the other century there on public television. That was the theme song called The Gaspé Reel. Well, we're talking to Angela Tedesco today, and we just mentioned that some folks are known for what they are really passionate about. And Angela is passionate about strawberries. We've had another Iowa farmer on the show, and it's Gary Guthrie. He's passionate about carrots. So if people, and what's nice is that the language of the of an area changes, because people can say, oh, Angela's strawberries, Gary's carrots. It means something to people, so that's good.
Well, and because if they're passionate about it, they usually have the best tasting carrots or strawberries, as it were.
That's the kind of stuff that you want to know. Yes, yes, yes. You mentioned the O word, and yes, it stands for okra, but it does also stand for organic. I want to talk a little bit more about Turtle Farm. Turtle Farm. I'd say it's close to Des Moines, not really. Well, it's close to Des Moines, but you are also surrounded by and have been more surrounded by and kind of got overwhelmed by housing development. Did you have challenges with dealing with being in a rapidly expanding urban environment, Angela?
Oh, yes. There were times when it was challenging. You would certainly be exposed to people's ideas about what a farm was. Some people thought it was fine to run over your ground without asking, even if it was, you know, a huge truck loaded down with whatever, because they had unloaded in a house that was being developed right next to the farm and couldn't get out because it was muddy, so they decided they would drive across the farm to get out so they wouldn't have to call a tow truck. So I did called the owner of that company because it was very obvious they had run across my farm making deep ruts in it. And I called the owner and I said, there's nothing you can do, because she asked, what can we do? And she was from a farm and knew better herself. I said, there's nothing you can do, but you make me feel better if you donate to Practical Farmers of Iowa. And she did. So, and another time somebody drove across the farm and ran over a peach tree, and he said, oh, I'll replace your peach tree, like it was, you know, something that you can just
get a new hat. Right, okay. Oh.
And we probably had more spray incidents as far as chemicals from the lawn companies doing the housing development.
Yeah.
Than I did from the farmer on the other side of the farm who always, you know, tried to be cautious about wind speeds and all that. So all kinds of things like that would happen.
It's amazing. When you farm, you have to deal with your neighbors no matter who they are. And I remember when your farm just started, it was right next door to the small town
Granger.
Granger, yes. I had the two water towers in my head. Granger.
Yeah.
And what a good place for a farm. But every time I would go drive by the place, there would be another house going up around, because, of course, what a nice place for a farm. Ah, what a nice place for
to build a house. Yeah.
To build a house. So did you have an experience that the people that lived in that housing development became your customers, or were they just sort of distant neighbors?
They were very close neighbors.
Oh, okay.
Right there. We watched those houses go up. We watched very painfully watched the earth movers come in and remove the topsoil and dig into the subsoil. And it was just like agony watching that happen. And then they, you know, would put in the house and then they'd sprinkle a little bit of dirt back over, like, you know, that's all that mattered. And everything would be just fine, but the neighbors found out that they couldn't grow very much in those backyards. But no, at one time I did, I had a farm stand on the farm, and so I wanted to go over and inform the new neighbors that I was organic and asked them to be careful with their sprays, whether they were doing it or if their lawn companies were doing it. And so I gave everybody a $5 coupon to the farm stand, thinking, you know, this would be a nice gesture and a thank you for being careful with their sprays, and nobody ever turned one in. So I don't know if they didn't like vegetables or what, or afraid of the O word. I did eventually have a customer who lived next to the farm, and that was very helpful because she could tell me, you know, if something was going on the farm when I wasn't there, because I did not live on the farm. And, you know, in desperate straits, I could ask them to run over and turn off the irrigation water or something. But that was about the
So she lived on the farm, basically. Yeah.
Well, see, right. Neighbors are important. It's really amazing that even those that want to, we want to live out on an acreage, we want to live out and be in the country, they still want to be pretty much in the
suburban,
city.
Yeah.
In the city, in the suburbs. Right. Oh, goodness, oh, goodness. Well, can you tell me a little bit about you are Turtle Farm is no longer, is it Turtle Farm or is it finished now?
Turtle Farm is no longer an active farming endeavor. When we decided to transfer the property, we thought a lot about how is the best way to do that, and we wound up selling a third of it so that we could afford to donate the other two-thirds to a nonprofit, and we chose Practical Farmers of Iowa after looking at four or five nonprofits, and it is still being farmed by a beginning farmer, or maybe he's not that beginning now. He was a young man who worked for me for a number of years, so he is currently renting the farm. So it's there's a farm still there, but it's not Turtle Farm.
Oh, does it just have a different name?
Or it's Wabi Sabi.
Oh, that's Wabi Sabi. Okay, okay.
See? It's okay. Good.
So
it's good.
So it's still being farmed by someone that you trained?
Yes. Oh,
good job.
Yes. I know Ben. Ben's yeah. Good. And good. I'm glad there's stuff going on there. That is good. You mentioned Practical Farmers of Iowa. It takes more than one farmer to create an adventure like this. Who gave you the inspiration and the help in starting a, not just an organic farm, but this different way of selling to people, the CSA? Who were some of your mentors and people that helped you along?
Well, it was interesting because when I went back for my master's in horticulture, there was really only one class called sustainable horticulture where you might learn something about a sustainable way or organic agriculture. But what I wound up doing was running off to organic farming conferences that were frequently in Wisconsin
Fun.
Or other places,
yes.
And learning from other farmers in Wisconsin or Minnesota and bringing those ideas back. And then at about the same time, there were a group of us, including Gary Guthrie and, maybe Joe and Lana, who were, you know, looking for new ways to start growing local food. And we would get together in groups and help teach new people about how to do that and help each other network. That's the best way, I think, for farmers to learn how to improve their farming is networking with other farmers. We share what are your successes and your losses, and you learn a lot from that. So that was my main training for starting this farm.
Good, good. Can we get back to some recipes? I noticed that your book included a lot of things about sweet potatoes. Talk to me about sweet potatoes, Angela.
That might be another southern crop.
Yes.
It likes the heat. It likes the heat, and so I would cover it with black plastic, or not. It was a permanent weed fabric, not plastic. I didn't like to use plastic because you just have to throw that away at the end of the season. So they like a really warm soil, and you plant the little slips in the spring, and you wonder how the heck they're going to survive because they're just little stems with a few tiny roots on them. And they just take off and grow. And then we harvested ours by hand because we were not mechanized to be able to do sweet potatoes with a machine. And it's such fun to dig these giant footballs out of the soil or smaller sizes. It's just a real joyous event to get them. And of course, you run into little mouse nests that were in there because they love the heat too, as well as a meal of sweet potatoes. But I really enjoy them a number of ways. One of my favorite ways is in a salad once again. So yeah, I enjoy them. It's another crop that you can grow in Iowa, especially if you can warm the soil.
Well, you have a recipe in the book. When you say sweet potato salad, my sweet potato salad is just like my white potato salad, only I substitute sweet potatoes. Do you have another thing that you like to do? Or is it just...
Well, there's one recipe in there that was adapted from the Okra cookbook, and it uses fruit and peppers and onions and has more of a mayonnaise-based dressing.
Uh-huh.
Mayonnaise and mustard, yeah.
Well, you have this other one, which sounds really good, sweet potato and mushroom pie. But the methodology is really unusual. It's... Can you describe that to us? It's not really a pie, except that it's round, right?
Well, I tend to make my pies or quiches without a crust because I try not to eat too many carbs.
Yeah.
So like, okay, it's not a pie, maybe it's a quiche or whatever, or tart or whatever you want to call it without a crust. So that one, I believe, is grated. And you saute up the mushrooms. I like lots of mushrooms. I believe it, I don't have it in front of me, but I believe it also has onions in it and some cheese. And
Gruyere, eggs, salt and pepper, 3 slices of bacon, 8 ounces of mushrooms, and a 1/4 cup of white wine.
Yeah, there you go. How can you not like that? You bake that in the oven, and it just makes a nice meatless main dish.
Good.
Well, we were just talking before the show about in terms of being vegetarian. And I have to say, so I was a vegetarian for 3 years, only from about 21 to 24 or 5. But one thing, when you cut out, you know, a lot of things from the standard American diet, which, of course, is meat and those sorts of things, you really learn to cook vegetables. And I learned to cook by being a vegetarian. It is a good way to learn to cook. It makes you try a lot of new things. So you've got a lot of vegetable recipes in here.
I think I have a wide variety there, dishes in there with meat, but I did tend to focus on vegetables since it's about, that's why
about
I was
cooking
growing.
Vegetables, right.
It's some of them can be adapted to be vegan or vegetarian as you desire. So, yeah.
Good. Well, I assume you're not involved with Turtle Farm as a place because it's turned into Wabasabi Farm, but I assume you have a garden.
Oh, yes. We retired farmers cannot function getting our fingers in the dirt. So, yes, I have a large backyard garden, a small orchard. I have raspberries and strawberries, of course, blueberries that don't do quite as well. And it's more than enough to keep me happy in retirement and very busy. So, and I have recently been expanding, you know, with flowers, prairie flowers, to encourage the beneficial insects. I'm pretty adamant about taking care of the bugs in their garden because there's beneficials out there. And, they need a meal, so you need the pests to be there so that they can have something to eat. So they're all important and part of the balance of a garden that you want to have.
That's good. That's what we need. People that have all of this wonderful knowledge. And your book does a good job of kind of wrapping up this story, and it's good. I'm going to take a little break here and remind you, this is KHOI, this is the Donalana Kitchen, and we're part of community radio. You can find out more about the Donalana Kitchen and more about this fine radio station and all the other good programming here at www.khoifm.org. Welcome back. This is the Dunnell in the Kitchen. We're talking to Angela Tedesco, a farmer, a cook, an author. Angela, with all of the stuff you grow, you certainly have ways of preserving the bounty for the winter. What's your favorite way of putting things by for the winter?
Oh, there's so many. Sometimes I don't have enough. We end up eating them all, but I like to freeze everything from asparagus to make asparagus soup in the winter, to freeze tomatoes. I even freeze tomatoes with okra and onions in it. That makes wonderful winter soup. It's a way to preserve okra, which is my favorite way, I guess, and probably only way. I like to dehydrate my herbs and some vegetables I have dehydrated. But freezing seems to be the biggest one for me. I don't can that much because I don't seem to have enough of things that I want to get off the canning equipment, but tomatoes is certainly one that I would can if I had enough. So
yeah, there's something about canning. It is a commitment, and I try to find other ways to do things too. We've been kind of experimenting with different things. Donna has run across actually a number of recipes for pickled tomatoes, right? Or fermented pickled tomatoes.
Some of the recipes are fermented, and some of them are simply pickled. But I have to say, in my inbox last night, a listener and a lovely friend of ours, Gail Hickenlooper, sent a recipe for pickled tomatoes that he found in a book from the early 1900s. And it's kind of a fascinating thing. You poke the pickles, prick the pickles,
prick the tomatoes,
right? And then you put them in a dish with salt for 3 days.
Oh, for 3 days.
And then you pour the vinegar. So, I think, thank you, Gail. I'm going to try that one first. Then we've got all the other Ukrainian ones. But there seems to be an element of fermentation in all of these pickled tomato recipes. So it's not your usual, it's not like making pickles.
Oh, goodness. So, Angela, we need wise farmers on land. We need healthy environment for us all. I think what you do when you have a CSA, the education and the connection with your customers is really an important thing. What have you learned from your customers?
Wow. Besides sending in lots of recipes.
Yeah, that's it.
I've learned some of my customers were so dedicated to the principles of organic farming that they didn't even like vegetables, but they still got a share.
Wow, so how does that work?
That's commitment, right?
Okay.
So I have a number of people that are just really committed to the idea. And then there are customers who, you know, like to cook. And, you know, they taught me a few things about cooking, my gourmet cooks that were in my group. The one who did the cooking class I thought was really helpful. So,
your average number of customers? What kind of numbers are we talking about here?
Well, my very first year, I thought, okay, you're supposed to start small, so I'm going to start with 15 customers. I thought I could handle that. It was on about an acre plot. And I had also decided, well, I'll make a half share available. Well, everybody wanted the half share, so it's like, okay, 30 customers. And so I made that the real size of the shares. And at my highest peak was 180 boxes that went out every week. And it was more people than that, more families than that, because some people would share a box.
Wow.
It was interesting. I learned from my customers things like, oh, I didn't realize I ate up so much. I'm having trouble eating this box of vegetables. They were more often complaining about getting too much food than enough, which is, you know, mind-boggling for me. My husband and I could devour a whole head of lettuce or two in a salad. And some people, you know, it would last them a week, you know, with little salads on the side. So, and I also learned about their preferences, the polarizing vegetables. They either loved okra or hated it. Same with eggplant and beets. Even, you know, my workers, they didn't like beets, and I loved beets. So it was a constant it was interesting. It wasn't really a challenge, but you couldn't please everyone.
My mother always used to say, there's no accounting for taste. And I, you know, literally, isn't that true?
Yes, definitely. Well, you had quite an adventure. And I think, is there any advice you can give? Because you've been kind of through a long transition. Community-supported agriculture used to be a really strange idea, and although maybe people are still scared of the O word, people are getting more interested in what they eat. Can you give some advice to people that want to start a CSA or beginning farmers? What would you tell someone?
I list in the back of my book some suggestions for either people who wanted to start a CSA or for those who wanted to join a CSA. And so for the farmers, my queries to them are, you know, can you grow a wide variety of crops? Can you juggle 30 crops that need to go in the box? Do you like people? Are you a good organizer and communicator? So there's a lot of things above and beyond just being a farmer that you need, I believe, to be a CSA farmer. And likewise, to be a customer, you need to be willing to try a wide variety of foods. You need to be able to eat with the seasons, which is what a CSA is all about. You're not going to get tomatoes in May, or may not get lettuce in August necessarily. So that's can be a challenge. Even though you could go to the grocery store, if you're trying to eat from the garden, it's what you have to do. It might be a good idea to share with someone else the first year to see if it's for you. You know, if you're gone on vacation a lot in the summer and won't be there to get your box, then maybe you should do the farmer's market. That's another good place to do it, or a farm stand near you, or your own backyard garden, whatever size that might be.
Good, good. Yes, because we have to maybe learn some new things with supplies and weather and climate, and things may be changing, and we have to remember that all of this stuff comes from the land, comes from the earth.
It's part of nature, whatever nature gives us.
Yes. Well, we've been talking to Angela Tedesco, and her book is called Finding Turtle Farm, My 20-Acre Adventure in Community-Supported Agriculture. Angela, where can we get your book, and who's the publisher?
The publisher is the University of Minnesota Press. You can get it by asking at your local bookstore, because they can order it if they don't have it in stock. I know Beaverdale Books has it. I don't know about the Ames Bookstore. It's also available on Amazon, but I'm more a fan of patronizing your local bookstore.
Very good. Very good.
Yes.
Also, you're involved in some upcoming events. So there's a PFI event coming up. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yes. PFI is doing a sort of a book launch event. It's going to be at the Iowa Arboretum, September 11th, starting at 1:30 in the afternoon until 3. So it's a lovely spot to go for an afternoon in September if you're available. There will be light refreshments, and so they would like for you to RSVP, but you don't have to come.
Good. That's September 11th.
No, it's located September 11th. It's located near Luther or Madrid, Iowa, and there are signs that will direct you there. And also, there's an event if you can't travel. There's a Zoom event coming up with a book discussion that the Iowa Food Foundation is holding for me. That you need to RSVP to get the Zoom link, and it's iowafoodfoundation.org. And that's the following Saturday after the Sunday PFI event. It's on Saturday the 17th at 10 a.m. in the morning. Thank you for letting me plug it.
Oh, sure. This part of the show, we kind of look around and say, well, what are some upcoming things? And you're going to be busy. You are definitely going to be busy. That's good. I'm glad that you joined us today. Thank you for joining us. And we spoke a lot about PFI, as if everyone knows it. PFI stands for Practical Farmers of Iowa. And if you want to find out more about Field Days, Angela's event, go to practicalfarmers.org. And they have a lot of information and actually a lot of other Field Days coming up. That's good. That's good. So how's your raspberry crop this year, Angela?
Well, the fall raspberries are just starting. The spring one, I moved my raspberry bed last year, so it's a little, not quite as abundant as it might be, but the fall ones are starting and they're looking pretty good.
Oh, very good. I've been picking too. They're just so good. How are you and the Japanese beetles getting along?
We have a little mutual respect society going on. I try not to bother them too much, and I ask them to reciprocate. And sometimes they're pretty good about that. They did, you know, they get the peaches that are high in the tree that I can't reach. So I let that go. I don't, when I had chickens, the chickens loved them. I would collect them for the chickens, but I don't have my chickens
anymore.
A
good combination there. Thank you for being with us today, Angela. And her book is called Finding Turtle Farm, My 20-Acre Adventure in Community-Supported Agriculture.
By the University of Minnesota Press.
University of Minnesota Press. Very good. Very good. Also, Donna, in a short bit of time here, tell us about how you can find us, not just through KHOIFM.org, but Donnell in a Kitchen is a podcast now.
Yes. In addition to our many, many years at this point of being on the radio, we are putting the same information into podcast format. So if you prefer a podcast, like while you're doing something else, but you've got your earbuds in, go to wherever you download your podcast. If you just look for Donna Lana, which is one word, D-O-N-N-A-L-O-N-N-A, Kitchen, Donna Lana Kitchen, and the podcast will come right up for you.
Good. Good. Thanks to you, our listeners, and thanks to our guests today. Also, another upcoming, there is a barn dance, Central Iowa Barn Dance, this next Saturday evening.
Are you calling it?
I am calling.
Lana is calling
Barnell
the barn dance.
Band, and you can find out more on the Facebook page, Central Iowa Barn Dance. Find out more next Saturday evening. Put your dancing shoes on. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We've had music today by the Barnell Band. You can find us here on the radio at noon on Tuesdays, repeated at 7 p.m.
Or in our podcast format.
Or in our podcast format. Support this fine radio station. My name is Lana Knox.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
We've had excellent engineering, as usual, by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.